This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts or redefining what it means to be creative.
I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Koslansky.
And we're your host for Art Moves. Today, we're going to be talking to Melody Capote. She is the executive director of the Caribbean Cultural Center of the African Diaspora Institute. Welcome, Melody.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We are so happy to have you. Heard so many wonderful things about you. We know that you've been at the Institute for over 38 years. So talk to us about what is the Caribbean Cultural Institute? I cut it short, but what is that?
Okay, so it's the Caribbean Cultural Center African Diaspora Institute.
Yes.
I like to say that in a nutshell, when we talk about the diaspora, we talk about the dispersal of African people globally, that wherever the slave ship stopped, we're there. So the work of the center really highlights the common thread we share as people of African descent. So whether you're from Puerto Rico, Jamaica, Brazil, Colombia, the one common thread we all share is our root culture in Africa. And that has been primarily the work of the center, is highlighting the cultural contributions of people of African descent and the creative expressions of our people as well.
So, of course, there's an intersection of African Americans in this as well.
Well, it's the African experience. It's
right.
The dispersal of African people throughout the world.
Yeah. Absolutely. So what do you see as the role of art and culture organization today, especially during this time of COVID?
You know, it's interesting because there's been so much work, so much said, and so much kind of using the word art and culture as exchangeable, and they're not. We're talking about culture. We're a cultural institution. And art becomes part of culture, as do sacred traditions and food and language. And so the role of art has always been one of activism, at least for what have been the works that we've produced as an organization that's an organization of color. And so we speak to the issues today are artists. We would not have arts institutions if it wasn't for the artists. And so we have always centered the artist first, and through the mission of the center, really tying in what is equity, racial, and social justice in the heart of our mission. So I think that when we talk about art and culture as kind of this movement, it really is based, I like to say that at the heart of it is culture, and everything else adds to it.
A lot of people may or may not know about the organization. If just give you like the brief, you know, elevator speech about...
You want my pitch? So the center was founded in 1976 by Marta Moreno Vega, mover and shaker in our community. She started the center as a research project. And actually, the center's legal name is the Visual Arts Research and Resource Center relating to the Caribbean. And what she found through some of her initial work was the traveling throughout the Caribbean, as I stated, really looking at some of the commonalities we share as people of African descent. So her work starts in Puerto Rico. She travels on to Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and I think Trinidad, and starts seeing many of the similarities, right? There are differences in language, there are differences in who the colonizer was, depending on which island we're speaking about, but that common thread, that root culture in Africa was one that... One, in many of these places, wasn't being highlighted in institutions. She found that many of the works that she was finding through her research were in boxes and in basements in places, even in those islands. And so it was about kind of digging this stuff up and bringing it to light and really being able to find a home for it when she comes back to the States and starts to do primarily visual arts exhibitions. Those then become a part of public programming, artist talks, panel discussions. And more we realized that through the creative arts and through creative expressions, we were able to start to realize that through the creative expressions, we could see the cultural contributions that people of African descent had made worldwide.
So now you're in a new space. Yes.
We're in a new building.
But also the genesis of it is a very interesting one. It came out of like some things you were doing by calling out the philanthropic community. Is that what helped to get the new space? I mean, what's the dynamics of that?
A couple of things. We started in East Harlem back in the 70s. Then we had a building on 58th Street and 9th Avenue. We were an affiliated program then of a program called the Phelps Stokes Fund. And the then president and was also ambassador to Ghana, Franklin H. Williams, said to us then in 1980, really stressed the importance of owning property and that not enough of us as individual people of color and even as institutions owned property.
Very important.
We owned the brownstone.
Right.
We owned the brownstone on 58th Street, which was then called Hell's Kitchen. And after being there 15, 16 years, the community started changing and we had Time Warner headquarters up the block. Now we were noted as being up the block from John Jay College, around the corner from Fordham University, two blocks away from Lincoln Center. All of a sudden, the narrative starts to change. We were no longer in Hell's Kitchen because gentrification was happening. And we started having internal conversations about our own value. What did it mean being in this area anymore? And the opportunity came to bring us back to East Harlem. And the then speaker of the city council, Melissa Mark Viverito, invited us to come up and be considered for a decommissioned firehouse. In fact, a landmark firehouse on 125th Street. So we jumped at the chance and we won the RFP. It was about 50 odd
organizations
and we won it. Took us 10 years to raise about $9.3 million to convert this firehouse into a state-of-the-art facility. And that is now our headquarters. I think the space you're speaking about is that just recently, in many conversations that we've had with developers coming into 125th Street, we like to say coming into the neighborhoods on steroids, there are about eight developers who are coming into just a certain strip of 125th. And I've met with all of them. And my question to each of them has been, how are you showing up as a good corporate partner?
Right.
And in the conversations with one, part of the community agreement was that they would make in every new building that they build, they're making a minimum of 5,000 square feet available to a community partner.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And we were the first ones.
Right.
We were the first ones to get one. So it was just announced last week that we will be at a location right up the block from the firehouse. So we're expanding our footprint in El Barrio in East Harlem. And we'll be on 3rd Avenue and 126th Street for what we are creating. We're calling it, it's the Institute for Racial and Social Justice in Arts and Culture, but it really is a space that will allow artists to come together and work together. It's a co-working space, if you will.
You're calling it a hub, right?
I'm calling it a hub. I'm calling it a beehive. I'm calling it a network. Right. We haven't landed on the space, on the what it is yet, but this is what I'm envisioning. It's really a place that will support artists coming together and creating, rehearsing, commission work, and be the source of, be the feeder for all of the productions and all of the work that the center does year-round.
Oh, that is excellent. And, you know, Melody, we know that you were a leading voice during the pandemic, really calling out the philanthropic institutions for their inequities. Talk a little bit about your experience doing that and how well was it received?
I will say this. We saw immediately after the shutdown of the city that the philanthropic community loosened their purse strings. Mm-hmm. They loosened their restrictions. Restricted grants, program grants became general operating grants. Small grants became bigger grants because they were putting more on the table, throwing more in the pot. And so what we saw was that we moved from a transactional relationship with funders to a transformational partnership with funders, and they were listening.
That was our next question too. Let's dig into that.
Yeah.
Transformational versus transactional.
Yeah, we started using that language pretty immediately. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
But is that traditional in conversations with philanthropic organizations, this idea of the difference between a transformative or a transactional relationship?
Well, traditionally, no. What we know is you get a grant, you do a program, you report back, and you either did or you didn't meet the deliverables, and maybe you're considered for a new grant or considered for an extended grant or not. In this instance, what we found was that the funding we were getting was transformational because, for the most part, all of those restricted grants were now opened up to become general operating. And it really was the lifeline and, in many instances, the survival or not of a particular organization. Because if we didn't have the money to pay staff, but you had to do a program, How did you do the program if you couldn't keep your staff on?
Which is interesting because, you know, a lot of philanthropic organizations are very interested in what the impact it is, because they want to make sure that their funds are really having an impact. But at the same time, there's not really a lot of mechanisms for doing that.
It doesn't exist.
And what? It's very anecdotal, too.
Exactly. What we have found now coming onto year two, right, we're in year two of the pandemic, is that while it worked. And I like to say, as foundations begun to free their endowments, because it's the endowment money and the interest on the endowments, which is the money they use for charitable
giving. There was resistance to freeing endowments, though. Isn't there a huge resistance to that?
Right. Yeah. So what we saw was, even with some of the kind of friendlier funders who were open to the conversation, was this is working. They weren't putting us through all the hoops of applications and review panels and how decisions were reached. They loosened the purse strings, they loosened some of the restrictions, and it allowed many institutions to be able to get through what was a real devastating time for our organizations and for arts organizations, but in particular, organizations of color.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. And we're talking to Melody Capote, Executive Director of the Caribbean Cultural Center for the African Diaspora Institute. So let's continue with this line of questioning, though, or inquiry, Melody. You're talking about transactional versus transformative. Let's talk about that systemic racism or systemic oppression that you were seeing when it came to how foundations were responding to the needs or have responded to the needs of organizations of color.
Well, we're talking foundations and we're also talking public dollars.
Absolutely.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
We saw and we've seen historically the inequities in funding from both the public and private sectors. So it was an opportunity. You mentioned earlier this voice on what was and still continues to be a call that we do called Culture at Three. And this started the week after the pandemic. And my understanding is that it started primarily with the major institutions, what they call the CIGs in this city. So there are 34 CIGs that get something like 80 to 85% of the city dollars. And the rest of us folk, which is about 1,200 program organizations, have to share or split the 15% that's left over. And the process is inequitable. You know, it's just that when you see the way the money is split, when you see the processes that we all have to go through an application process, a panel review process, the funding is never sufficient. And it's primarily restricted to programs where the CIGs get operating money and they get salaries and they get utilities and they get security. And the rest of us just don't see that. So that we started.
So they're well subsidized.
Absolutely.
And everybody else is kind of left to fend for themselves.
Could you explain what CIGs are?
CIGs are called the Cultural Institutions Groups.
Okay.
So they're primarily the large white institutions in the
like
city that are considered.
Opera, yes.
Yeah.
So
it's not to say anything against the CIGs, simply that we understand
share.
That the pattern and
right.
the share is just not equitable. Mm-hmm.
Right, so to get a balance of it. So what do you think would you think have to be a shift in the philanthropic organizations themselves to be able to rebalance that? Is that something on the border?
Well, I don't know that the philanthropic world can balance it. I think, one, when we talk about the public dollars, it is taxation without representation, because we're all putting our tax monies into the city, and these are tax dollars that aren't distributed equitably when you look at the neighborhoods that haven't, the haves and the have-nots, right? On the philanthropic side, I mean, when we talk about the wealth that exists in many of these family foundations, quite honestly, it's built on the back of Indigenous and Black people. And this is how this wealth is built. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we talk about the distribution of that wealth or how we reinvest in community, that's a conversation that folks don't want to have, but it is what it is.
That is a conversation that people don't want to have, but it's essential because it is what is undergirding all of this inequity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the idea that that we're talking about it right now is something that needs to really be unpacked. So we were in a moment with George Floyd and COVID and all of that where people were being somewhat responsive to these kinds of public outcries. Do you see that continuing?
I like to say that for our communities, we faced several pandemics. One was the Black Lives Matter, that Black lives do matter, and that we were walking with targets on our backs, and COVID-19. And communities of color were hit hard with both of these, right? I mean, everybody was affected by COVID-19, but when you look at poor communities and communities of color, we were hit the hardest. And so we, as an institution, after George Floyd's murder, I was inundated personally through emails and texts and calls from white colleagues and some allies and some just really not knowing what to do. with that very question. What do we do? What do we do? We were inundated with messages of solidarity by other organizations. And it annoyed me. I wasn't about standing in solidarity. It was about the action. And what we did as an institution is we took the opportunity of participating on the Culture at Three call, and we put together a series of anti-racism training webinars that were open to the arts community as a whole, but primarily attended by representatives of white-led institutions. So we had the participation of about 200 representatives of 100 white institutions throughout the city who participated in this training.
Okay, that's excellent. Right.
And what it
hopefully
did,
that's transformative.
Hopefully. It did several things. As an institution that has really never, it wasn't our job to teach white people what to do.
True.
Right?
Right.
But we also saw that leaders of institutions were turning to us as the thought leader. And I took the responsibility, I took it as a personal responsibility to do something. Mm-hmm. And so through the trainings, what we did was offer up an opportunity. It was a total of 9 hours. It wasn't any, you know, nobody walked away with a certificate. You're not now anti-racist, right?
Right.
But it really just allowed an opportunity, a really kind of safe space for our conversations to happen, where we were encouraging leaders of institutions, their boards, their staffs, to take a look inside, take a look inward, and define some of the what of their institutions was systemically racist.
A while back, you hosted a very intriguing YouTube show on race myth, arts equals justice. And in it, you talked about this idea about thriving beyond the performative.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about what that is? I mean, it's a very intriguing phrase.
Well, first, we didn't host it. That was hosted by Dr. Vega, has another organization called the Creative Justice Institute. And she had a series of panels to which this was one.
Thank you for that clarification.
No, thank you.
Just go by the notes.
No, that's fine.
It's like
that's
a real
fine.
Old track.
It's us.
It's fine. And I like the opportunity to be able to clarify it.
Yes.
So she hosted a series of conversations that were, again, being in the moment, right? In fact, that series was a result of an exhibition that we hosted just before she transitioned away as ED of the center, which was Race, Myth, Art, and Justice.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talked about thriving beyond the performative, it's speaking again to this notion of getting funded to do a thing and doing the thing.
And that's it.
Then it's done.
That's done. Right.
Right. You perform.
No relationship. There's no relationship.
There's no extension.
Right.
There's no support or encouragement or additional funding that says, take this further. Let's explore this a little further.
Let's make a real investment, right? You know? Exactly. It's a transaction. It's not a real investment.
And that's what we're talking about. So when we talk about thriving beyond the performative, it's all of those things. It's the funder feeling good about giving. It's us feeling great about receiving and then delivering on a program or delivering on a thing that once, you know, the package is done, it's done. And so what we did through that panel was explore other ways of being able to do what we do. Again, using the examples of the moment where funders said, let's do business a little differently. And that's exactly what we saw in that moment. What we've seen since then is that everybody's kind of gone back to their old practices.
That's what I was. That's been my chief concern.
That's why we went back to the old ways.
Right. But that's why we have shows like this to keep the momentum going, to keep the conversation alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wondered if you could speak a little bit about cultural appropriation. I wanted your take on that and then how that influences and impacts the work that you do.
There's so much there, right? You see, everyone loves our music. Everyone loves our style. Everyone loves the patterns in our clothes, the hair. And yet, again, when we speak to systemic racism, it's like the credit, the value, the affront that folks can really feel that they can just grab what's ours and call it their own, right? It's very much the conversation when you look at the institutions along Fifth Avenue. Their collections are those items that have been stolen from our culture, right? Indigenous culture, African culture. There's stuff on display in some museums that shouldn't be on display because they're sacred.
Oh, interesting.
Right? But it's their art. Our sacred objects have become their art objects. Talk about appropriation. I mean, now there's this big drive by corporations and institutions to be more DEI, diverse, equitable, and inclusive, and now even accessible, DEI.
And belonging, that's in there too, belonging.
And I prefer belonging to inclusive, so that's become kind of a whole other thing.
But in some ways in itself could also be performative.
Yeah, right, I mean, that's a checklist. So you hire another person of color to be on your staff, and you add another person of color on your board, that makes you DEI? Right? We talk about accessibility. Are we talking only about ADA accessibility, or are we talking about access for all people, by all people? Right? And so even those definitions and those checklists, through our trainings on the anti-racism webinars that we did, folks were like, well, we're meeting all the DIE standards. That doesn't make you anti-racist.
Absolutely not.
You know, it's just so much work to do.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking to Melody Capote about the Caribbean Cultural Center African Diaspora Institute.
You know, Melody, this idea of a cultural appropriation and robbing, I understand that. But don't all cultures blur? Meaning, do we blur, especially in this country where...
Blur?
By that I mean boundaries are blurred. You know, I mean, everybody appreciates everybody's culture. I'm just asking. This is a question where people appreciate each other's cultures and they just start doing those things because they enjoy doing those things. What is your thoughts around that?
I don't know. I mean, I can't speak for everybody. No, I don't know that. I don't necessarily know that to be true. I know what I appreciate. I know what I'm exposed to. I know what I'm not exposed to. Mm-hmm. I know when there's an invitation to be a part of something and when there isn't an invitation to be a part of something. But then there's the flip side of that is privilege, right? And so I don't have the privilege that my white colleagues have to be able to make those choices regardless. Mm-hmm. I don't have that same access and that same ability. I mean, I won't say I don't have. I guess we all have it. But when we talk about privilege and we talk about, you know, wealth and access, we're not all of the same playing field.
No, absolutely.
You know,
not.
And
no.
So I don't know that there's a blur. For me, I see very clearly what's black and white.
And I guess what I was speaking of is when we look at cultural activities, meaning I square dance, you know, that's not my culture, but I do that. You know, that's kind of where I was going with this. Like in just the day-to-day living, there are things that we enjoy about each other's cultures, and we don't even know it's a culture. It's just what we do.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
There's also what's the line between being sourced by something or inspired by something and appropriation.
Where's that line?
Very, you know? Very good point. Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was reading originally about Rick Bayless, who, you know, he's a Chicago chef, Mexican, but, you know, he's a white guy from a barbecue place in Ohio or something.
Right.
But, you know, he spent years studying the anthropology in Mexico and cooking and things like that. But he gets accused of appropriating Mexican cuisine. But is he not allowed to cook Mexican because he's not Mexican?
Well, we all have Mexican food at home. We'll eat a taco or a quesadilla, right? So it's I guess it just depends.
But you know what I'm saying? It's like, where's the balance?
Yeah, how you honor it. Or maybe how you honor it and how you pay homage to it and how you think about it.
Yeah,
maybe
I think that's the distinction, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that you understand where this is all coming from. And there's a bit of honoring. I would say,
and I'm seeing it more and more, even this notion of folks acknowledging the land.
Speak about that.
Folks talking about it.
Because I wonder if it's just words. Sometimes it just seems like something people are saying because it's politically correct. So if you could explain that.
I think that there is that. I mean, we are sitting on stolen land, and nobody says that when they do a land acknowledgments, right? The acknowledgment that a land and a people were brutally abused and that the land was stolen and it resulted in the oppression of a people, that's not what's acknowledged in a land acknowledgement. And I think at the point where, you know, I've been on way too many Zooms, way too many Zooms in the last 2 years. But to even acknowledge, I'm sitting on the Lenape land.
Right.
Right?
Right.
No one can talk to me about that. What does that mean? When someone does that land acknowledgement, what does that mean? And I'm not, this isn't a test.
I get you.
To say, you know, folks will say that, but, you know,
I think it's politically correct, quite honestly, when I
people,
hear it.
People lost their lives. People lost their land. People lost their culture.
One of my favorite news stories was these Native American protesters in Montana and people coming up with them, they should go back where they came from.
So much of it, too, is, we think it begins with us.
What's that?
You know, the history, meaning a lot of folks think that where they are in America, it just began with them. They're not caring about the fact that the Lenape were brutalized. They're not thinking that far back. Mm-hmm. They're in their bubble. They're in their bubble.
And there's a very romanticized narrative that folks have. Again, mm-hmm. it comes to privilege, right? We know as enslaved people, historically, right? Because we can say today, well, I'm not enslaved. You know, that I don't work the field.
And there are a lot of folks that want to feel that way. They want to discard it.
And we can't. Right. That is our history. Right? And so there's no way of being able to detach ourselves from that.
Mm-hmm. Now let's speak about when artists speak about reparations, what do they mean when they speak about that?
I would say there's so much there. Everyone's so concerned about their organizations, but no one's talking about the artists. That first week of COVID, my immediate reaction was, what about our artists? We had 45 artists, teaching artists in schools, who now had schools closed, couldn't do a gig. If they were wait staff or bartenders somewhere, everything shut down. And we were able to secure some funding to create a project. And I was mentioning this earlier, when I asked about the how easy was it for you to bring your work onto the digital platform, because that's what happened, right? Everybody all of a sudden was Zooming and Google Meets and all kind of ways of Instagram and do Facebooking and doing all of these events. And for many of our artists, the access to that type of technology or those devices wasn't available. We also had a number of artists who were kind of more seasoned and older artists who did not know how to use this technology. And so we created a program we called DEAR, Digital Evolution Artist Retention.
Yeah, fabulous.
And the intention of that was to work with individual artists to prepare them for the moment, but more importantly, to prepare them for when the doors open and they could hit the ground running and be as competitive as their colleagues. Particularly their white colleagues, right? So when we talk about reparations, it is the equal access and it's the monetary reparations, and how do we get that back? We're very clear that when we tell our story, it is a story that comes from a position of strength. We tell a story that uses an Afrocentric lens because we know that the Eurocentric lens always looks at us as a deficit, from a deficit. And so when you know the story of African people, when you know the story of indigenous people and the survival of this culture, even today, right, that you have folks who can see that drop of blood, that 1%, right, that 1% that makes you African or an African descendant, that 1% that makes you indigenous, we're saying we're the ones that are telling the story and not storytelling.
Honestly, you are so authentic.
Thank you.
I just enjoyed listening to you, quite honestly. Everything that you said really resonated with me. And again, we'd love to have you come back and talk more. And talk more. You know, maybe you can come on and co-host every now and then.
Sure. I'll take a vacation.
No,
I'm going to kidding.
No.
But there's a quote that comes to mind, that there's nothing as powerful as an idea whose time has come, led by an unassailable messenger. And that's how you strike.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. That's so nice.
You're quite welcome. It's been a delight.
Absolutely.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.
This has been Art Moves with your hosts, Tony Williams and Eli Kuslansky. Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.